This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. Each night, we're here to answer your questions.
Hi, this is Jordan calling from Montana.
This is Catherine Conger.
Hi, this is Gordon in Seattle.
I'm hearing rumors online.
The idea of sewing our own surgical masks has recently come up as a project some of us can do at home.
My question about COVID is...
My question is...
And I was just wondering...
Should we take cold medicine?
What markers do officials use to predict when a virus peak will occur?
Who would win?
Is there a role for homemade masks?
If there's any truth in that whatsoever.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tonight, NPR journalists and outside experts are with us to answer your questions about the latest announcements from the White House, what doctors need to know about the virus, and how to protect yourself from testing scams. Send us your questions about any of these topics, and also tell us how you're coping. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation, or on Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. Each night, we begin the National Conversation by answering the question, what happened today?
We're going to go through a very tough 2 weeks.
Tonight, a sober briefing from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. President Trump described semi-trucks outside a Queens hospital being used as a temporary morgue.
To see the scenes of trailers out there and what they're doing with those trailers, they're freezers, and nobody can even believe it.
Dr. Anthony Fauci estimates that the death toll in the U.S. could reach six figures. He also said there are signs that social distancing is starting to work.
Now is the time, whenever you're having an effect, not to take your foot off the accelerator.
So far in the U.S., the disease has killed 3,600 people, surpassing the 9/11 death toll. Seema Verma is the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. She told NPR today the U.S. government is waiving regulations for what constitutes a hospital so states can quickly add capacity.
We want to empower our hospitals and our healthcare workers that are on the front lines and give them the flexibility to deal with the crisis at hand.
Michigan is one place that will need the help. COVID-19 cases are exploding there. More than 1,100 cases and 75 deaths just in the last 24 hours. In New York, the governor says FEMA is competing with states to buy ventilators, driving prices up. And in Maryland, Governor Larry Hogan, a Republican, told NPR the president is wrong when Trump says testing is not an issue.
Yeah, that's just not true. I mean, I know that they've taken some steps to create new tests, but they're not actually produced and distributed out to the states.
Well, we're joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, who's here to explain what we heard tonight and answer your questions. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Ari.
It was a big change in tone from the White House this evening. The president and his advisors saying, be ready, there could be anywhere between 100,000 and 240,000 Americans killed by this virus.
It was a very downbeat briefing. The president was not sugarcoating it. It was very honest. Any period of denial that the president has, I think, is now over. He said we're going to have more deaths than the world wars. The 100 to 200,000 death estimate is based on models that assume disciplined, widespread mitigation. In other words, that everyone socially distances.
Meaning that if they don't, the numbers could be even higher than
yes.
that.
And the models that they showed at the White House today show that without doing anything, the deaths could be 1.5 million to 2.1 million. So this was a real change in tone from the White House. The president said this is not the flu. That's new. In the past, he had said it was like the flu. He told people to wear scarves, he acknowledging that there are not enough masks. They have to be saved for health workers. And he also acknowledges that in some states, like Washington State and California, they have been very proactive. They acted early. They instituted social distancing early. And their curves, their rates of cases and deaths are much lower. And during the time that those states were instituting those procedures, that was the time when the president was not only attacking the governor of Washington State, but denying that the virus was going to be that bad.
Right. We are getting so many questions coming in from listeners. I want to get to a few of them. Let's start with Lee from Santa Barbara, California.
Why is FEMA buying up medical products, sometimes taking away from states and cities that have already paid? How can they do that? And where is the equipment going? Thanks so much.
That question, of course, a reference to the attack from the New York governor who was criticizing FEMA for driving up the prices. Yeah.
Right. The Andrew Cuomo, the New York governor, said that every state has to do their own purchasing. It's kind of like eBay. They're all trying to buy the same equipment. The 50 states are then competing with FEMA, who's also trying to buy the same equipment. And he says FEMA's bidding up the price. What the FEMA says that they're processing orders through the supply chain. They're coordinating with the governors. Today, when the president was asked about this, he said, well, they should just call us. We're giving them tons of ventilators. They should be, you know, we're being very generous with them. What the governors want is for the federal government to allocate resources, set a price, and coordinate things, not have a kind of bidding war for these products.
We have another question here about the relationship between state and federal governments. This comes from Catherine in South Carolina.
My question is, if governors continue to close schools and order social distancing, but the president orders the government to open, who would win?
Mara, how does that work out?
I think the governors would win. That's why Trump's guidelines are called guidelines. They're recommendations because they're not enforceable. States and local governments have very broad powers to handle public health crises, more broad powers than the federal government has. The federal government has more money, but the state and local officials have police powers to maintain public health and safety that the federal government does not. And also, as a matter of policy, the Trump administration says it will defer to the states. If he says if they have stricter measures, that's okay.
You know, it seems like in every national crisis or war or such events, one voice comes out who people sort of end up turning to day after day. And there have been several in this crisis. One of them is Governor Cuomo. And we have a question about him from Erica in New York.
In regards to Governor Cuomo, he's been doing such an excellent job informing us morning, noon, and night. And if he were to get sick and be in the hospital, does New York have somebody like ready to go that is going to step in for him?
Yes. But that question really goes to how big a figure Andrew Cuomo has become, where people are literally worried about what happens if Andrew Cuomo gets sick. But if he was too ill to hold office or to function, the state's lieutenant governor, who is the second highest position in New York state government, would assume the role of governor until Cuomo was able to return. That's the case in most states in the United States. There are five states that don't have lieutenant governors, but in that case, there is someone else second in line, like the Secretary of State or the state treasurer.
Mara, you've covered President Trump from the beginning of this administration, and in so many cases, he has rejected the guidance of experts. Early on in the coronavirus crisis, he did the same. Now he seems to be listening to experts. Do you think that is a permanent state of play, or is there a risk that at some point in the future, in this crisis, he says, no, actually, I know better. I trust my own instincts?
Well, that's what he used to say. I know more than my generals. You know, I'm very good at this. I think that he's not just accepting the guidance of experts. I think he is embracing these experts and clinging to them. I mean, I think that he deferred to the scientists over and over again today at the briefing. That's something he's been doing more and more, but today it was particularly striking. He has come to believe what they are telling him, that only mitigation and social distancing will keep the death rate down.
That is national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Thanks for your help, Mara.
Thank you.
And now we have NPR senior science editor Maria Godoy here with us to answer a couple questions. Maria, good to have you back.
Thanks, Ari.
As Mara mentioned, the president was asked about wearing masks today, and there has been a back and forth between the CDC and the World Health Organization. President Trump suggested people could wear a scarf and not go out and buy masks when healthcare workers need them. What are health experts saying about whether ordinary civilians who are healthy should be wearing masks in public?
So the official CDC guidance is still that only people who are sick or caring for someone who's sick should wear masks. But the CDC says it is reviewing that guidance now to see if it might encourage broader use of masks. And the White House task force is actually also reviewing it. The reason is scientists are learning that a lot of people who are infected may have no symptoms at all, but they can still spread the virus. So a number of infectious disease experts are now calling for people to wear masks in public to slow the spread of the disease. And just to be clear, it's not so much to protect themselves from infection, but to prevent them from spreading it to other people.
Our understanding of this disease is changing so quickly. I also wonder if you can give us just a snapshot of what the country looks like right now, as New York has surpassed Wuhan, China, as the city with the most cases of the virus. At the same time, Michigan's cases are rising at an alarming rate. What does the country look like at this moment?
Well, sadly, this virus is going to impact the entire country. Although, I mean, some places are clearly going to be hit much harder than others. And the fact is, there's a certain amount of infection already out there, and we can't do anything about it. But the hope is that the social distancing in place will slow the rate of future cases. But, you know, Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Task Force today did point to California and Washington State, and the fact that they've managed to keep their rates of new cases down is a hopeful sign that if we keep these measures in place, we can flatten the curve. But if you look at the models they had already in states like Florida, Louisiana, and Michigan, they're emerging as hotspots.
Yeah, that is NPR science editor Maria Godoy. We appreciate your joining us once again. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks. Thank you, Ari.
And if you have questions, we want to help. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation. On social media, we're using the hashtag NPRConversation. Up next, the death toll from COVID-19 has now surpassed 3,000 people. We'll speak with NPR science reporter John Hamilton about the significance of that number. I'm Ari Shapiro, and this is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. Today, more than 3,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. That is a higher death toll than 9/11. The U.S. also has the highest number of reported infections in the world. Many of you have asked us questions about the spread of the virus, the rates of infection, and survival. So to give us some answers, we're joined now by NPR science correspondent John Hamilton. Hi, John.
Hi, Ari.
Let's dive right in with this question from a caller in Michigan.
I'm a 68-year-old woman in good health with mild hypertension. If I were to contract COVID-19 and require hospitalization with a respirator, what are my chances of surviving? What is the recovery period?
It's a frightening question to consider and one that so many of you have been asking us. So, John, I know you've been reporting on survival rates. What can you tell us?
Well, there is a short and I'm afraid to say unpleasant answer to Emily's question. And that is that, you know, her chances of survival would not be great. Let me go through a couple of the reasons why that is. I mean, first, there is some good news here. Her mild hypertension, for instance, is not a significant factor. But on the other hand, Emily is 68, and coronavirus is fatal for about 3-4% of people between 60 and 70. It's about
3-4%. Okay.
3-4%. And it's about twice as high for people between 70 and 80. So that's not good right there. Mm-hmm. But the big risk factor she described is being in the hospital on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think Emily said respirator, which is a mask you wear to filter the air that you breathe. I think what she meant was ventilator.
Yeah.
And that's a device that essentially breathes for you. It is a last resort. You don't end up on a ventilator unless your lungs are in such bad shape they're no longer be able to provide enough oxygen.
I see. So if you have a mild case, you're not likely to need a ventilator. But once you have a ventilator, it's a sign that things may be pretty dire for you.
Right. And so far, the statistics from China and elsewhere suggest that your chances of surviving if you end up on a ventilator are certainly less than 50% and maybe quite a bit less.
All right. Let's take this question from Amy in Watsonville, California, who wants to know about tracking casualties.
I've heard that if you haven't been tested for the virus, your death won't count as a COVID-19 death, which means that the actual numbers are so far below the true counts of who has died as a result of this virus. That also means that every community has no idea how many more actual deaths are to be attributed to this pandemic. And I think if we all knew the true numbers, so many more people would be on board with this physical distancing practices.
That's a really interesting question there from Amy. We've all heard about people who had symptoms but weren't tested. If those people die, are they counted as COVID-19 deaths, John?
Well, so Amy is partly right. It is true that in most countries, you're not classified as a coronavirus patient unless a test shows that you have the virus. So in theory, you know, if you died without being tested, you would not show up in the statistics. But that's not really what's happening, at least in the most of the world. In most countries, the people who are being tested are precisely those people who are so sick they are likely to die. Those people usually end up in the hospital, and hospitals are really aggressive about testing. So it's pretty unlikely that we're missing a whole lot of deaths from coronavirus. On the other hand, we are still missing a whole lot of people who are infected but don't get that sick.
Okay, so the death rate is likely to be more accurate than the infection rate because so many people may be asymptomatic and just never know that they had it. Let's go next to a question from Elizabeth in Portland, Oregon.
What is the government planning, what are public health institutions planning to help deal with another surge, given that most people aren't going to be immune and the virus could still spread? Are there ways, are there plans, even while the emergency is happening, to tackle kind of a second surge similar to how they did in South Korea?
Yeah, John, I think a lot of people have been wondering when the social distancing measures end and everybody starts going out to restaurants and bars and being social again, will there be another wave of infections?
It is quite likely, yes. Elizabeth is right. Most people won't be immune even months from now. So even if we have the virus under control in the U.S., it could easily come back. And that's why there's so much talk about this phrase, you know, flattening the curve. The idea is that if you use measures like social distancing to slow down the spread of the virus, everybody won't get sick at once and overwhelm the hospitals. And you look at places like, you know, South Korea, which you mentioned, and the number of new infections seems to be falling right now, but they still have lots of measures in place to keep people apart, to keep them from getting infected, and they are testing lots and lots of people. So if the virus starts spreading again, they'll probably know, and presumably they'll clamp down again. I know in the U.S., health officials have talked about a second surge of cases, but, you know, at the moment, we're still focused on the first one in places like New York.
So you're saying even when things go back to quote-unquote normal, they might not look like the normal that we had before this broke out in the first place?
Not if you're going to keep the infection in check, no.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned flatten the curve because our next caller brings up that very question. It's from Denver in Jacksonville, Arizona.
Where I am, there seems to be a completely different reaction to this health crisis. Demand for testing is overwhelmed, and yet grocery store shelves are empty. What is a person supposed to do to be a responsible citizen and help flatten the curve, especially if there isn't any support for us to stay home?
What advice do you have for her, John? How can Denver help flatten the curve in this situation?
Well, you know, flattening the curve is not easy. It requires people doing things that make it difficult to get through daily life. And I think for every person, it really comes down to this. You have to balance out what you need to get through the day with measures you can take to reduce the risk. So, you know, you have to eat, you have to go to the grocery store, but can you do it in a way that minimizes risk? Do you wash your hands? Do you keep track of how your distance from other people? It's a balancing act for everybody.
Well, and also balancing the temptation not to hoard, so you leave things for other people, but also not wanting
toilet
to go to the supermarket every 3 days.
Exactly.
We have so many good questions coming in. Let's just keep plowing through them. We have one here from Eugene in Indianapolis.
What measurements is the federal government monitoring to let the public understand the effectiveness of the 15 days to slow the virus?
It's a great question. John, how do we know if it's working?
Well, most of what I know from, like a lot of Americans, I've been listening to Dr. Anthony Fauci, sort of the leading federal spokesman on coronavirus, right? And he and others have been trying to explain that 15 days, it's a marker. It's not an endpoint. So the idea is that if you change behavior today, you should see some sign of fewer new infections and cases a couple of weeks from now. The problem is you need a whole lot of testing to really know how much impact you're having. And right now, we're only beginning to get enough tests to really make good measurements on our progress.
Well, we have so many more questions that we're not going to have time to get to, but we are here 5 nights a week. So NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, hope we can have you back again soon. Thanks for answering all these questions for us.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow on The National Conversation, we'll answer your questions about the census. How is everyone being counted during this outbreak? Also tomorrow, what questions do you have if you're expecting or know someone who's pregnant? We'll get answers for you. Send us those questions. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation or use the hashtag NPRConversation on Twitter. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. The coronavirus has already infected at least 850,000 people around the world. There are still lots of mysteries about this new disease, including how to treat it. In this segment, we'll answer some of your questions about what to do if you think you have COVID-19, whether any particular drugs seem to work, and what can happen if you go to the hospital with symptoms. We have two experts with us to answer your questions. First, Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician at Brown University and Lifespan Health Systems in Rhode Island. Welcome.
Thank you, Ari. It's a joy to be here.
And epidemiology professor Anne Remoyne is an infectious disease expert at UCLA. She studies diseases that humans get from animals, like COVID-19. Welcome to you, Professor Remoyne.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Ranney, will you begin by just describing how your hospital is dealing with the arrival of COVID-19 patients in your emergency department in Rhode Island?
So in Rhode Island, we've been preparing for the COVID-19 pandemic, honestly, for months, since those first reports came out of Wuhan about the new virus. We've been doing our best to get adequate stockpiles of personal protective equipment and to create procedures to help us manage the surge of patients, which has already started. The trouble is, of course, that there's inadequate production and access to many of the life-saving supplies that we need, things like masks and gowns, but also things like drugs that we need to treat everyday emergencies. So we're constantly pivoting day by day to try to fill gaps and plan ahead so that we can take the best possible care of our patients going forwards.
That sounds so challenging. Mm-hmm. We've heard about the use of ventilators for very severe cases. What other kinds of treatments are you using for people with COVID-19?
Most people who develop COVID-19, thank goodness, have mild symptoms that can be managed at home. So we take care of them the same way we would take care of most patients with influenza. We tell them to rest, drink plenty of fluids, take medications like acetaminophen or Tylenol. But some patients are sicker. They need inhalers, things like albuterol, the stuff that folks with asthma use. They need IV fluids. They need oxygen. And sometimes they do need those more intensive care measures like blood pressure support, ventilators, and similar interventions.
Have you seen those treatments working? Are you having good outcomes?
So it's early to say whether or not we are having good outcomes. In Rhode Island, like across the country, COVID-19 is a brand new disease. And in New York City, my colleagues there are just having the very first wave of patients make it through the ICU. Based on data from Washington State and from China, we're seeing that somewhere between 25 and 50% of patients who get admitted to intensive care actually survive. It may be as low as 10 or 20%. We're still waiting to see which interventions are most successful and what the true survival rate is.
Those are really sobering numbers. Professor Remoyne, I'd love to bring you in here because what Dr. Ranney is seeing at the grassroots level, you study from the 10,000-foot view. So is what she's describing consistent with what the models that you study had been projecting?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the problem has been that we don't have the equipment. We don't have the ventilators. We don't have the testing. And we don't have national strategy, which has made this all very, very difficult. I think that the key is the first issue is we don't even know where we are in this epidemic. And the lack of testing has taken us completely, has made it very, very difficult for all of us to understand where we are.
Testing, yeah, you mean beginning, way, middle, or, I mean, we're not at the end, but how close to the middle maybe?
Exactly. We have no idea where we stand. Countries that have known where they are at a peak have had widespread testing. We have no idea where we are. And so how can we be prepared? How can hospitals like the ones we're just talking about now be ready for anything? This has taken us unfortunately, by a complete surprise, and not because we didn't know something like this could happen, but because we didn't have national strategy on it, and that pandemic preparedness had been underfunded for decades. Yeah. But I do think that what the doctor is saying is very important. You know, we just do not have these tools in place, and it is devastating.
Well, we have a lot of listener questions coming in, and this first one is one that I know many people have been wondering about. It comes from Judy Duenas in Melrose Park, Illinois.
My question is, I'm hearing rumors online that acetaminophen increases your chance of getting COVID-19, no matter what your age is. So I needed to know if there's any truth in that whatsoever.
I've seen these rumors for a while now. Dr. Rani, what are you advising your patients about taking acetaminophen or ibuprofen if they have COVID-19?
So acetaminophen and ibuprofen are two very different drug classes. They both treat fevers and muscle aches and the things that many of us feel if we get COVID-19 or other similar illnesses. There's some preliminary data out of the World Health Organization suggesting that taking ibuprofen, also known as Motrin or Advil, might maybe increase the chance of bad outcomes if you're infected with COVID-19. But that data has not been replicated adequately outside of that initial WHO report. So I and other physicians across the country are telling patients, you know, first off, if you're feeling sick, if you have muscle aches or fevers, take acetaminophen or Tylenol first. And then if you're still not feeling good, if your fever still isn't under control, there's a risk-benefit discussion, but ibuprofen is probably safe to take as well.
Let's take another question here from Katie in Brooklyn.
If you have symptoms but don't require emergency assistance, what do doctors think we should be doing? Should we take cold medicine, flu medicine? I know they say get lots of rests and fluids, but what else can we do?
I think so many people are concerned about overtaxing the healthcare system. What advice do you have?
I love that question, and I thank her for asking it. So if you're feeling sick, the first thing to do is to try to get in touch with a healthcare provider. If you have a primary care doc, try calling, or if you don't, try using telehealth. Go to an emergency department only in the worst possible scenarios, because we don't want you to get sick by showing up or to make other people sick. If you're well enough to stay home, drinking lots of fluids, taking ibuprofen or acetaminophen, and yes, cold medicine, just kind of, and then the most important thing is making sure you don't infect other people. So making sure you quarantine, don't go out to the grocery store. You may even want to sleep in a different bedroom from other family members and be very, very careful about washing your hands.
Well, and apart from COVID-19, I for days had been saying, don't do something stupid like break a toe. And yesterday, scrubbing a bathroom tile, I cut my finger deeply and thought, I'm not going to urgent care. Fortunately, it was okay. But I heard from all of these people who said, oh yeah, I broke a toe and splinted it at home because I didn't want to go into urgent care.
So it's so interesting. We're actually seeing across the country decreased number of patients in the emergency department for the normal things that people come in for. So we're seeing decreased number of people who cut their finger or have belly pain or chest pain. So I totally sympathize, and I thank you for thinking about keeping away.
All right. We have a lot more questions coming in, and we will have more answers as well from Dr. Megan Rani and Professor Anne Ramoyne. Thank you both for being with us. We're going to take a brief pause. And you're listening to the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. Professor Ramoyne, we have a listener question here for you about prevention. This comes from Carl in Poughkeepsie, New York, who is looking to help, but he's not sure how.
I work in a community of makers and artists who would like to help in any way we can. The idea of sewing our own surgical masks has recently come up as a project some of us can do at home. Our question is there a role for homemade masks? Do homemade masks play any role in preventing the spread of novel coronavirus?
Professor Ramoyne, what would you advise Carl?
Well, I think that this is a very timely question because, as you know, right now there is a big debate going on as to what the role for widespread masking is and in terms of prevention. So what I have been telling people is that masks, there are two different issues at hand. One is that our healthcare workers need personal protective equipment. They need PPE. And that is the number one most important thing we can do, is to protect our precious resource of healthcare workers who will be able to manage this outbreak when people get, or this epidemic as people get sick and come into the hospital. Without PPE, we are putting everybody at risk. Now, there is another theory that COVID-19 is spread not only from what we've been thinking about as this large droplet where people are coughing or sneezing onto people, but that these very small, fine speech droplets play a role. And as such, when people speak, they are able to release droplets into the air that are invisible and can hit other people. And that appears to be a driver of community transmission. So these masks can play a very important role. Non-surgical masks, leave the surgical masks and the N95s for healthcare workers.
And if you've got a sewing machine, it can't hurt to make one from scratch.
Please make masks and cover your mouth. Everybody can do their own, do a job of acting like they have asymptomatic COVID and keeping their droplets to themselves. If everybody can keep their droplets to themselves, we can potentially drive down community infection. And so I think that this is something every person can do, and this should not take away from the critical PPE that is required for healthcare workers.
We're also getting a lot of questions about ventilators. So let's go to this one from Gordon in Seattle.
I was just wondering what percentage of patients in respiratory distress that are put on ventilators do ultimately recover?
Dr. Rani, it sounds like you're saying it could be a very low percentage, actually.
It could be a low percentage. Data from Washington State, as well as from China, suggests again that it may be somewhere between 10 to 50% of patients put on a ventilator. We know that the longer you're on, the worse you'll do. I'm hopeful that with our high-quality medical care in the United States, if we can keep it that way, if we can have adequate numbers of ventilators and staff and medications, we will have percentages on the higher end. But right now, we really don't know.
Some helpful, albeit sobering, information there from emergency physician Dr. Megan Rani of Brown University and epidemiology professor Anne Ramoyne of UCLA speaking with us on Skype. Thank you both for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
And you can hear much more of our coverage when you download the NPR One app. Go to the Explore tab and click on the coronavirus outbreak for a curated stream of stories. And if you have questions we want to help, go to npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. I'm Ari Shapiro, and this is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. As scientists struggle to learn more about the coronavirus, bad information is filling spaces where people don't quite have answers yet. Scammers are luring anxious people into spending money on false medical products. Nick Hanna is the top federal prosecutor for the Central District of California.
We do want to send a message that we are out in force. We're going to be aggressive on people who try to take advantage of the current situation. And, you know, we are not going to be lenient about it.
We're joined now by Tom Dreisbach, an investigative reporter with NPR's Embedded podcast. He has been looking into a California company claiming to sell test kits, and that reporting has gotten the attention of Congress and law enforcement. Tom, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So your reporting followed the source of a company that was claiming to be doing at-home COVID-19 tests. Tell us about them.
Right. This is a company called the Wellness Matrix Group here in California. About a week ago, they were selling online what they claimed were at-home test kits that were FDA approved, only $49.95. I called company representatives. They insisted to me they had FDA approval. But when I pressed for details, they could not provide any convincing evidence to back that up. Now, the FDA itself confirmed to me repeatedly they have not approved any at-home test kits. We spoke to more than a half dozen people who bought the tests. They say they never received anything in the mail, now more than 10 days after ordering. And in response to our reporting, members of Congress with the House Oversight Committee sent the company a letter with a series of questions. The LA City Attorney here in Los Angeles asked them to cease and desist any sales of home tests. Now, finally, just today, this afternoon, after we've been asking questions for days, the company began claiming it never intended to sell at-home tests. It claims it's offering full refunds. But I have a lot of questions about that statement, so we're going to keep reporting.
There's a lot of information there, but one thing that I think would be really helpful to underscore for listeners is that the FDA has not approved any at-home testing to be sold directly to consumers. So anyone seeing those kinds of ads can just assume off the bat that it's a scam.
Yes, we cannot stress this enough. The FDA says it has not approved any at-home testing. If you see anyone selling a supposedly at-home COVID-19 test, you should know it does not have FDA approval. Now, the agency says they absolutely see a value in thinking about and pursuing at-home testing at some point, but they need to make sure it actually works. And because getting a false positive or false negative could really have bad consequences for people's health.
Well, we have one of the people who bought a test from this company on the line with us now, Chelsea Gooden. Welcome to the program, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. You guys are heroes, because when we kind of learned about this, we had no recourse, except you guys have done so well.
Well, how did you learn about it? I mean, I assume you saw an ad for the test, you bought it, and then what happened?
Well, we kind of got it through a friend group, friend of a friend, like, hey, here's an inside track to this test that hasn't gone public yet. You can get in on it first. It's FDA approved at home testing. And we just got sucked into it. You know, everyone was feeling fear. You know, we've been hearing how there's no tests available, and I was feeling even symptoms, and we just got sucked into the frenzy of it. And I usually pride myself as a person who researches things and wouldn't normally be sucked into something like that.
And when did you get the impression that maybe this was not all that it claimed to be?
Well, just a day or two later, we started reading, I was just reading news, and I found out, oh, there's these people scamming for tests. And so that's when we all started sleuthing around. Our friends did, our amazing friend PJ did a lot of sleuthing, and we connected with NPR, and we've now since learned so much more and feel so taken advantage of.
And are you expecting to get your money back?
Well, you know, we called our credit card company, who was on the case also, and said they're going to look into it and get credit back. So that's been a really good outlet for us. And I intend on going through the whole refund process, but it, I mean, everything about it seems so ridiculous now. It's hard not to look back and feel silly about getting sucked in.
Well, Chelsea, we appreciate your telling us your story so others don't get sucked in as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Tom, it seems like these sorts of scams pop up whenever there's a crisis. Is there a general rule of thumb that people can use to not fall victim?
Well, I think one of the things I heard from people who had bought these tests was really trust your gut, that they had an instinct when they saw the website that said, this doesn't feel quite right. Maybe when you see these sites, take a moment, check with legitimate public health sources, your state and local health authorities, the FDA itself, and make sure that the information you're getting is coming from legitimate sources.
Tom Dreisbach is an investigative reporter with NPR's Embedded podcast. We appreciate you digging into this and sharing your reporting with us, and we'll look forward to seeing where it goes next.
Thanks, Ari. Appreciate it.
Every evening, we have been trying to end this program with something uplifting. And I don't follow many celebrities on social media, but in the last few weeks, there have been two performers of a certain age whose Instagram accounts have brought me a lot of joy. You remember Charo, the flamenco guitarist who popularized the phrase coochie coochie? Well, she has been doing broadcasts from her home in Beverly Hills. In one, she teaches you how to create your own toilet paper using a roll of paper towels and a bread knife. In another, she offers a suggestion for what to do in this time of social quarantine when you want to hug someone.
I'm gonna kiss everybody and hug everybody. No, anymore. Even if it's your baby daddy lover or your lover or your partner or your future lover or your boyfriend, your girlfriend, whatever, your neighbor. No. Before you hug it, count 6 feet back. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco y seis. And then you say, ¿cómo está?
On the other side of the country, there is Leslie Jordan. The short, southern, flamboyant actor is cooped up in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Welcome to Pillow Talk by Leslie Jordan. Today's story is about Betty White. I was hired one time on Boston Legal, and the other co-star was Miss Betty White. She said, how many episodes have you been hired for? I said, five. She said, me too. I'm going to kill you, or you going to kill me. Sure enough, episode five, she walloped the bejesus out of me with a skillet.
He makes these pillow talk videos and also exercise videos where he shows how to use a back scratcher to do things like scratch your back. And then sometimes he just channels what so many of us are feeling.
It's still March. How many days in March? When is April gonna get here?
Well, my friends, we've made it to the end of March. You might have noticed that tomorrow's April Fool's Day, and this year NPR is going to skip our tradition of embedding a ridiculous made-up news story somewhere in the broadcast. But here at the National Conversation, we want to know about the good-natured pranks that you are planning to play on the people you are quarantined with. Tell us at npr.org/nationalconversation or let us know on social media with the hashtag NPRConversation. My co-host Michelle Martin will be here in the host seat tomorrow. I'm Ari Shapiro. Thanks for listening. This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.